My name is Eric Verrier. I'm the CFO of Anacap Financial Europe. I'm happy to welcome you today to the Anacap Financial Europe SA SICAV Reef year-end presentation for the period ending December 31st, 2020. As set out on page two of the presentation, Justin, Ed, and I will take you through the presentation, and then we will open the line to the Q&A session at the end. In addition to Q&A session, please remember you can send any questions through to info@anacapfe.com or through the website at www.anacapfe.com, where we will aim to reply as soon as we can. Details can be found at the end of the presentation. Before we begin, can I please draw your attention to the disclaimer on page one of the presentation, which highlights that the presentation is produced solely for informational purposes and cautions against any forward-looking statements, and that by attending this call and reviewing the presentation, you are agreeing to the limitations set out on page one of the presentation. I will now pass on to Justin Soldier for the 2020 highlights.
Thanks, Eric. A year ago, when the impact of COVID became starkly apparent, we completed a thorough reforecasting exercise in the midst of the first widespread lockdowns across Europe, significantly pushing out expected recoveries on our portfolio overall. In the time since, both the relative pace of recovery and openness of European economies continues to ebb and flow. However, throughout, we have maintained a highly proactive and engaged approach to managing performance, delivering 34% outperformance in gross attributable collections to the company's prudent reforecast completed in April 2020. Without question, this was made possible by the significant investment we made in the company's own asset management platform over the past several years, which now includes 19 full-time employees across the U.K., Luxembourg, Italy, Spain, and Portugal. This not only serves to optimize performance and rapidly address challenges when they arise, but also delivers growing capital-light income for master servicing and special servicing assets, where AIF is co-investing alongside Anacap's closed-end opportunities funds. That co-investment, which historically only incorporated NPLs, has also now extended to include direct real estate and potentially other high-yielding performing debt opportunities, offering strong risk-adjusted returns. With both market and economic dislocation emerging over the past year, we have seen significant repricing of real estate assets in particular. But the inevitable increase in NPL supply expected as a result of this crisis has thus far been slower to come to market. With a generally highly disciplined and patient approach to deployment still in 2020, the company invested only 21 million euros, which included co-investments into both secured NPLs and nine real estate assets across Italy and France. However, with additional transactions already signed in 2020 for another circa 15 million of deployment in 2021, and with a strong pipeline beyond that, we are confident that this year's deployment will return near an annual run rate of circa 100 million euros, even before what so far in Q1 looks like a strong start to the year in collections performance. The company has ample liquidity of almost 90 million to capitalize on this growing opportunity set. A liquidity position which is further underpinned by what remains a predominantly variable cost model with low overheads. Turning to slide six. In our annual results this time last year, we presented this chart to provide a broader perspective on how Anacap's credit business has evolved over more than a decade. Both in terms of geographies and asset types, we have always looked to build upon our network and expertise to unlock value across a range of asset types, seeking investments which deliver consistent cash flow and/or hard asset backing. Real estate, of course, builds directly on our extensive activities in secured NPLs and real estate secured debt more broadly, where we are both tapping into many of the same origination channels, but also skills in underwriting, pricing, and managing real estate assets for disposal. In fact, more than 50% of all capital deployed across both AIF and Anacap's opportunities funds has been secured either directly or indirectly by real estate. In terms of asset management, just as we have always maintained a master servicing-led approach to debt investing, selecting servicers and tailoring requirements to each transaction, so too are we selecting the most appropriate operating partners to support the asset management of real estate including management, repositioning, and ultimately sale. In several instances, we are working with the same external partners on the ground and seeking to provide solutions to real estate in typically distressed situations. But we are always leveraging our expanded internal capabilities and seeking to cherry pick the best opportunities overall. In doing so, AIFE will continue to co-invest alongside ANICAP's opportunities funds, not only in NPLs, but also in direct real estate and potentially other opportunities, where AIFE can assume asset management responsibility and generate capital-light income from the entire investment. I'll now turn it back over to Eric to touch on the key financial highlights.
Okay, thank you, Justin. I'm now going to quickly cover the financial highlights, and then Ed will build on this, going into recent developments in our core countries, including specific details on our ERC and underlying collateral, and updating you on AIFE's further development of its asset management platform. Turning to page 8, key financial highlights, 2020 collections have been resilient and exceeded initial post-COVID expectations. Despite the challenges faced from COVID-19, the group can report a successful year of collections performance against the COVID-19 reforecast set in March 2020. Attributable collections for the fourth quarter were $25 million versus a target amount of $22.2 million in our COVID reforecast, which is a 12% overperformance for the fourth quarter. As a result, the attributable collections for the 12 months ended December 2020 were $86.6 million versus our COVID-19 reforecast of $65 million, representing a 34% overperformance in collections for the year. The overperformance in Q4 was largely driven by proactive asset management by the group's dedicated master servicing platforms. Highlights include accelerating cash in court distributions in Italy, despite disruptions to courts, as well as achieving significantly higher than expected residential real estate sales in Portugal, both in terms of overall volume and values achieved. The group also negotiated a successful sale of a legacy Italian unsecured consumer NPL portfolio in December 2020 for $2 million, crystallizing a $1.1 million gain on sale. The group completed its third portfolio evaluation exercise of the year during December 2020. Again, cash flow timings and assumptions were revised where appropriate, with caution maintained on the outlook of COVID-19. The company expects that COVID-19 will continue to impact collections performance during at least the first half of 2021 due to further potential lockdowns and a gradual ramp up to backlogged court proceedings. We're glad to report that no write-downs or gains were recognized following this portfolio review. So last 12 months, adjusted EBITDA for the year decreased to $53 million as collections were delayed into the future. This was still up 42.7% compared to our Q1 COVID-19 forecast. Please note that the reconciliation of adjusted EBITDA is on page 29 of the presentation. Also, revenues finished the year at $65 million, which is flat compared to our COVID forecast of $66 million. During 2020, AIFE deployed $21 million in 8 transactions at an average expected gross money multiple of 1.96 times. As Justin mentioned, this included 5 secured NPL investments in Italy for around $9 million and 3 new investments in direct real estate, whereby AIFE purchased 9 well-located properties across Italy and France for $12.1 million at a combined expected gross money multiple of 2.3 times. The group also signed 2 further direct real estate deals in December 2020. As a result, AIFE expects to deploy an additional $14 million or $50 million in 2021 in respect of the 9 properties acquired and of these 2 signed transactions. The lower than expected deployment in 2020 meant that ERC dropped slightly to $472 million for the year, which is relatively flat compared to our Q1 COVID forecast of $478 million. Net debt also dropped to $330 million as at year end, which is 17% below our COVID reforecast and also as a result of low 2020 deployment. We go into 2021 with ample liquidity of $85 million to fund both the $15 million backlog of signed deals and a significant pipeline that Justin will cover later in the presentation. Turning to page 9, key financial highlights, collections from existing portfolios are expected to grow in 21 and 22. Let me first start by explaining the graph. The gold bars show the 84-month ERC as of December 2020, which is post our Q4 evaluation process. The blue bars show the 84-month ERC from our COVID reforecast. The shaded blue section adds the impact of deployment to ERC since the Q1 COVID reforecast, so you can see a static snapshot of the change in timing of ERC. The key change in the revised forecast is highlighted by the difference in the bar charts, and that is one of timing, of expected collections, with a significant overperformance in 2020, driven by an acceleration of collections from future years. As a result, we expect a decrease in 2021 forecasted collections to 114 million, compared to 143 million in our adjusted COVID-19 reforecast. The change in timing of collections from our year-end evaluation process did not result in any change in the book value, nor did it impact the 84-month ERC. The change in timing in ERC will impact projected EBITDA for 2021 and, as a result, leverage. We are forecasting the 2021 collection target of 140 million to be more distributed towards H2. We have a prudent Q1 collection target of 16.4 million that we are currently on track to deliver. Turning to page 10, key financial highlights. ERC remains backed by significant collateral entering into the direct real estate market, allowing for further diversification. The following charts illustrate the diversification of AIF's 84-month ERC by asset type and geography as of December 31st, 2020 and 2019. Geographic diversity provides resilience to economic cycle in any one country and local market trends, and combined with the asset diversity, provides access to a greater investment opportunity set. As Justin mentioned, AIF is aiming to further diversify in other asset classes where ANACAP has a significant expertise and track record. AIF already completed or signed 5 direct real estate investments in 2020. 2 of these investments were in France, and in Q1, we also completed 1 additional direct real estate investment in the UK, which further diversified our ERC by geography and asset type. As of December 2020, year-end direct real estate accounted for 6% of ERC. Turning to page 11, key financial highlights. Leading cost structure enabled continued positive cash flow despite a slowdown driven by the pandemic. As Ed will cover in more details in the next section, AIF made some further investment in its asset management infrastructure in 2020. AIF added 10 employees during the year and now has 19 full-time employees as of December 2020. During 2020, the company also entered into a framework services agreement with entities within both the ANACAP Credit Opportunities Fund 3 and ANACAP Credit Opportunities Fund 4, pursuant to which AIF will now provide them with master servicing, portfolio administration, and asset management services. The investment in AIF's platform has been key to driving 2020 collections performance, with both master servicing and targeted internalization of special servicing, optimizing performance, and also generating 2 million of additional capital light income for the company in 2020. As a result of these investments, the fixed cost increased to 12.5 million compared to 10.4 million in 2019. However, our overhead structure is still predominantly variable, and relative to the value of the portfolio held in the business, AIF's total operating cost remains market leading. The increase in our operating cost ratio from 25.9% in 2019 to 38% in 2020 was also driven by a change in asset mix with higher percentage of unsecured Italian NPL and maturity of older secured portfolios where legal activity is higher. It is worth noting that the operating cost ratio of 38% we refer to is the total operating cost rather than a cost to collect ratio, and therefore includes all of the overheads of the business. Please note also that for the computation of this ratio, we use core collections, which differs from attributable gross collections used for ERC. A reconciliation for 2020 collection is on page 30 of the presentation. Turning to page 12, key financial highlights. AIF maintains a strong liquidity position with no near-term financing requirement to support. As at year-end, both LTV ratio and super senior RCF ratio were well within covenant levels at 69.9% and 0% compared to 75% and 25% for the covenants. LTV is expected to slightly increase in Q1, but is expected to finish the year below 65%. As a result of the lower EBITDA and net debt in 2020, the leverage based on the last 12 months adjusted EBITDA increased to 6.21 times at 2020 year-end. Our 2021 collection target of 114 million is more weighted towards H2, and as a consequence, we expect a small decrease in EBITDA and increase in leverage in the coming quarter, with a peak leverage at around 6.5 times. However, we expect that leverage to resume its downward trajectory in Q2 and reach below 4.5 times by 2021 year-end and between 3.5 to 4 times by the end of 2022. On the liquidity front, we currently have 85 million of immediate liquidity available. This combined with our 114 million collection forecast means that we have sufficient liquidity to return to our long-term run rate of 100 million plus deployment in 2021. We're always looking at refinancing opportunity, but we don't expect a need to go to capital markets in 2021. We are currently looking to open discussions with RCF lenders in Q1 21 with the aim of extending the RCF maturity to December 2023. We continue to constantly review our capital structure and liquidity position, and we'll look to optimize this over time. Depending on market conditions and our operating results, this could include open market repurchases of securities, amongst other strategies. No dividend will be paid on the back of the 2020 results, and we do not currently anticipate any dividend in 2021. I will now hand over to Ed for an update on core countries and the asset management platform. Ed?
Thank you, Eric. So as Eric and Justin alluded to, I think the critical driver of the positive relative performance over the last 12 months has been our asset management platform. And the combination of boots on the ground in key jurisdictions and consolidated centralized information via our digital platform, Minerva, has given us live intelligence on the evolving dynamics in each jurisdiction. We've been able to adjust our collection strategy dynamically to optimize performance and identify quickly those recovery channels that have been viable through the crisis. Within AIF today, we now have an asset management platform of 19 highly skilled and experienced professionals with capabilities spanning all aspects of the collections and real assets value chain. The team benefits, of course, from the broader ANICAP investment platform across UK, mainland, Europe, and India. And asset management activities are supported by a team of over 60 data scientists and system engineers across UK and India. Particular highlights of the last 12 months have been the continued development of our special servicing activities, especially in Spain, where we intend to internalize more assets from third-party services on the back of very strong relative performance of our internal capability, who, through a bespoke, focused approach, have increased the velocity on follow-up of legal files, delivering improved relative results. Given the visible proof points in collections performance uplift in all jurisdictions, this platform is now positioned to continue to drive revenue through provision of asset management services to ANICAP funds. I'm now going to briefly step through each of our jurisdictions, outline the highlights for 2020, and how our asset management platform is going to build on that momentum and address the evolving challenges of 2021. Starting with Italy on page 15. Consistent positive performance was observed in Italy through last year, with outperformance against each quarterly target. In Q2 and Q3, the main driver was cash and core acceleration, resulting in an overall performance of 10.2 million in Q2 versus a target of 3.2, with Q3 at 7.9 versus 5.9. With the appointment of a senior asset manager in Italy in September, Q4 finished strongly, supported by tactical initiatives to dispose of subsegments of our unsecured book at a value greater than our ERC. In Italy at the moment, amidst rising COVID cases, regional restrictions continue to be tightened by the Italian government. Our strategy will be to build on the initiatives established last year, drive continued acceleration in our cash and court stock of 12.9 million, close down an amicable pipeline of 7.4 million, and pursue targeted sales of subsegments of our unsecured book. And in parallel, ensuring that we can drive as great as possible momentum across these initiatives to mitigate the impact that tightening restrictions are having on the marketing of secured assets. Moving on to Portugal on page 16, Q4 finished closely in line with target at 6.9 versus 7.1. Like in Italy, outperformance over the course of the year was driven by a tight focus on driving cash releases from resolved cases through persistent engagement with judges and receivers, resulting in an especially strong Q2 performance of 7.5 versus 2.5. In addition, the team on the ground have capitalized on continued strength in the residential property market, which is up 5.5% year on year, to drive asset sales. Portugal has been in a state of national lockdown since the start of the year, with easing only starting to take place from mid-March. Through this lockdown, we have continued to look to drive sales for residential assets, and as lockdown emerges, we'll launch new targeted campaigns in our unsecured portfolio to increase our subscription rate to seek to mitigate challenges of further legal delays across the secured book. Moving on to Spain on page 17. Spain was a challenging market through 2020, especially the traction on legal processes and conversion of amicable settlements, with evidence of financing banks taking a cautious approach. These challenges resulted in an underperformance to target during Q4, with collections of 2.3 million versus a target of 3.5. And as we go into 2021, the situation remains challenging, with regional lockdowns in place to restrict movement of people across the country, and courts, while open, are continuing to operate under capacity. Our strategy for this year is to continue to drive internalization and use our own resources on the ground to drive a forensic approach to the progression of legal cases to drive recoveries. And finally, our other market, on page 18, definite challenges in each market, full national lockdown in the UK, regional restrictions in Romania, and Polish courts not open to the public, but performance was very resilient, 3.1 versus 1.2, very stable performance across our UK portfolio, and outperformance in the quarter driven by targeted collateral sales in both Romania and Poland, strategies which will continue this quarter. So in summary, the combination of central intelligence and local presence has allowed our asset management platform to deliver a strong relative performance in 2020. And looking ahead to 2021, we'll continue to look to adjust our strategies to address evolving COVID challenges whilst continuing to build the asset management platform's revenue base. I'll now hand back to Justin to outline the strategic outlook.
Hi, sorry, Justin. I think we were disconnected on our end. Apologies.
No problem. Thanks, Ed.
Picking back up on slide 20, I wanted to expand further on some of the themes underlined at the outset today to provide additional insight into our strategic outlook for 2021 and beyond. After two consecutive years of more limited deployment, the company is poised to build on the momentum in Q4 by continuing to accelerate deployment once again in 2021, where we believe we will be able to capitalize on opportunities at significantly more attractive returns than seen in recent years. Whilst NPL portfolio sales are still ramping back up following a COVID-induced slowdown, we are already seeing opportunities to deploy capital at more attractive returns, including on the secondary side, and eventually, we believe, on the primary side, as the inevitable overhang on bank balance sheets comes through as the real, more lasting economic impact of COVID takes hold. In the meantime, we have already mentioned capital deployed into direct real estate opportunities, which is adding both further asset type and geographic diversification, as well as the commensurate growth in capital-light income the company is expected to deliver by asset managing investments for both AIF and ANICAP's opportunities funds. With this in mind, we have already highlighted continued development in the company's platform, which will maintain a nimble approach by combining a digitally enabled platform with tactical teams on the ground in key geographies. From a balance sheet perspective, clearly we have more work to do on both the deployment and collections front, with both expected to increase and bring leverage down to a longer-term run rate below 4x adjusted EBITDA. However, to do so, given the company's strong liquidity position, we do not have any additional near-term funding requirements. Turning to slide 21, we wanted to provide a bit more color on what we are doing on the direct real estate front. I highlighted earlier that over 50% of all capital deployed across AIF and ANICAP's opportunities funds historically is either directly or indirectly secured by real estate. Specifically, in direct real estate, ANICAP has acquired a total of 16 commercial properties since 2015, 11 of which AIF has co-invested in beginning this past year. This represents a broad mix of asset types across residential, student housing, logistics, office and hotel properties in markets well known to ANICAP including Italy, France, and the UK. Typically, these are situations emerging out of some form of seller distress and or where financing is more limited in the mid-market, particularly where assets require more intensive asset management or repositioning prior to sale, but are in top, more liquid locations. Moreover, by co-investing alongside Anacap's closed-end funds, APE is able to invest across a broader range of opportunities to further enhance diversification. From a pipeline perspective, the volume of such investment opportunities has been accelerating markedly since the onset of COVID, allowing us to focus on the most attractive assets. Examples include a cherry-picked mixed portfolio of residential and wider commercial properties in Milan and Rome, which the company acquired to directly enable the pay down of debt owed to an Italian banking group well known to Anacap. Secondly, an income-generating office property in the affordable outskirts of Paris, sold by a private investor unable to provide basic maintenance capex. And three, a small regional office property in the UK, which was sold by a real estate fund facing severe liquidity pressures. Turning to slide 22, to put recent deployment into context, we have outlined expected gross money multiples by vintage since 2012. As many of you will recall, the early years shown here between 2012 and 14 reflected a blend of both secured and unsecured NPLs, with a shift to more of a secured NPL focus prior to the establishment of AIF in 2017 and since. The company's focus on secured NPLs reflected not only where we believe AIF had competitive advantages and differentiated expertise, but also due to the fact that as money multiples compressed, it became even more difficult to find comparable multiples in unsecured debt over an 84-month horizon, as highlighted here. However, as you will see reflected in 2019 and 20 deployment, we have seen not only marginal improvement in gross money multiples in secured NPLs, which represented the entirety of 2019 deployment, but also highly attractive opportunities in direct real estate, as evidenced in 2020, at greater than a 2.2 times gross money multiple. Whilst we do expect the supply of more attractively priced NPLs to continue to grow again, it will take time for these to work through the system post-COVID, whilst the real estate pipeline remains exceedingly attractive today, as discussed. Turning to slide 23, we have provided more detail on the profile of the company's real estate investments. This chart represents a blended real estate portfolio comparable to recent deployment, set out alongside a blended portfolio of recent secured NPL investments. You will note that the real estate portfolio delivers strong cash flow more rapidly, combining both current income and regular disposals, delivering exceptional returns over an 84-month horizon, over a 48-month horizon, versus the steady but lower and more protracted returns delivered by the NPL portfolio over an 84-month horizon. Asset management is also, of course, less tied to any legal proceedings and potential timing volatility associated with legal recoveries, where we maintain ultimate control over when to sell individual properties. Finally, turning to slide 24, you will see a breakdown of our current pipeline. This represents a typically large and diversified opportunity set, with almost 70% by capital required comprised of NPLs and real estate. As discussed already, we expect NPL volumes to gradually increase throughout the course of 2021 and beyond as increased provisions across the European banking sector turn into NPLs for sale. However, in the meantime, we do expect to continue to capitalize on direct real estate, with capital deployment representing another 15 million euros already signed and clear visibility to significant further pipeline at similarly attractive returns. In addition to NPLs in real estate, Anacap maintains a focus on non-core performing debt and higher yielding asset types. However, with up to 100 million euros to deploy this year, the company aims to continue to deploy capital at the best risk-adjusted returns over an 84-month horizon, where gross money multiples across much of the NPL and broader PL pipeline we are seeing remain too low. The company is also committed to deploying capital by co-investing alongside Anacap's opportunities funds, where it can generate incremental capital light income by deploying its asset management resources across the entire investment. In aggregate, we expect capital light income to reach at least 15% of total revenue by 2023, which may include additional third-party servicing revenues. However, we expect income where AIF is not investing any capital at all to remain relatively small. Thanks for taking the time today to join us, and we'll now turn it over to any questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star followed by the one on your telephone keypad. Also, if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, that is star one at this time. And we'll go first to Rory McLaughlin with Blackstone Credits.
Thanks for the presentation. Just three questions from my side. Just wondering, could you provide a bit more color on the trajectory of deleveraging over the coming year? And just on, I suppose, on the revision of collections for 2021, based on my just quick maths, that reduces EBITDA guidance from about, I think it was mid-90s previously to a mid-70s level. I'm just wondering, is that right? And then just also wondering, just in terms of discussions with S&P, I believe it's likely to be reviewed again in the coming months. Has there been any kind of a early guidance on what they're going to do with the rating? And then finally, on just on the RCF, you mentioned the discussions will kick off with lenders over the coming weeks, but has there been any discussions previously, and what's your, I suppose, your expectation on that end? Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for your questions. Let me answer the easiest first. On S&P, we've had a regular conversation with S&P over the last few weeks. We sat down with them, we had a phone with them a few days ago, just highlighting the outcome of the Q4 results. S&P is doing their annual review in the month of April, so we have a follow-up call with them at some point in mid-April. We'll do a full presentation and sharing our model as well and our forecast. Probably too early to say what the outcome would be. I think their credit review is going to be at some time in mid-May. So as we look at the trend on the, and maybe touching on your second question, as we look at the trend on the deleveraging, I think we would expect, as we look at, you know, finishing this year closer to 4.5, and as I mentioned in the presentation, finishing 2022 more in the 3.5 to 4 type territory, we would expect a positive outcome from the rating at that point in time. The question will be, when is the right timeline? So as I mentioned, because of the profile of our 2021 collection, we would expect leverage will go up slightly in Q1 to probably around 6.5 times before it comes down to 4.5 times by the end of the year. So I hope that answered most of your questions.
I just had one point. I think your EBITDA estimation is broadly in line with our with that forecast of deleveraging that Eric mentioned. And then the RCF.
Oh, sorry, on the RCF, we've had a conversation, obviously, ongoing conversation with the banks. We're at the stage now where we're sharing our model with the banks, and depending on the appetite, we'll start the process. We would like to complete the process by mid-May. So whether we can close the refinancing or the extension with the current syndicate, or whether we need to include some additional banks, too early to tell. We will obviously would like our bank funders to support the business as we deliver. So we'll see where we end up. But it's positive so far.
Perfect. Thank you.
We'll go next to Maria Galata with SoundPoint Capital.
Hi, thanks for the presentation. I've got a few questions as well. So are you able to give us any idea on the current trading for January and February and whether that is in line with your 2021 year expectations? And then just like if you can give us an indication on how much you're planning to buy in 2021, and I think I heard that up to 100 million number. If you can please confirm that, and whether that's going to be roughly like half in real estate, if I understood correctly. And then could you please give us some indications on the money multiples you're currently seeing for NPLs right now and IRRs that you're currently observing in the market? And then finally, whether you can disclose anything on your plans to address bond maturities. Thank you.
Yeah, I can start and maybe we can fill in the gap. I mean, first off, just as a highlight for trading, I think Eric mentioned we are broadly on track this quarter so far. Yes. So we're optimistic on that outlook. I guess, you know, it is worth mentioning that there is a significant ramp up still to come later in the year. I think our forecast, we believe, should prove quite resilient given the fact that we're still in an extended period of lockdown, but certainly by the second half of the year, we're expecting a further ramp up. In terms of deployment, yes, around 100 million plus or minus would, we believe, be the target. That's quite consistent, you may recall, with where the business was running in the years prior to 2019. And we certainly think we can get back to that, and liquidity is already clear and visible in terms of being able to accomplish that. Certainly half or more of that potentially in real estate is possible. As we sit here today, certainly, I think given the market conditions still, as we said, NPL proceeds have been slower to ramp up this year, whereas the visibility to deploying potentially at least that amount already in real estate is clear to us. So we're quite confident in our deployment targets overall across the two. NPL money multiples, you can see a little evidence in 2019 in the chart we showed that we do believe they've been creeping out. However, we think it's been gradual. I think if you look over an 84-month horizon where multiples we felt probably at the peak, where we believed a true all-in net IRR inclusive of all costs, kind of 2018-19, probably peaked in the high single digits and money multiples below 1.5 times, in our view, have definitely started to push back out. We believe IRR is probably close now back in the low double digits and money multiples back between 1.5 and 1.6 times. We think that's the right pot. It's a movement in a positive direction. We don't think we're the only investors who've changed our targets to reflect that. However, the volumes have been small. I think one of the challenges, obviously, when supply slows down, there's still a lot of capital out there on the demand side. So we think we need supply to catch back up, which it will over time, to adjust and establish a longer-term trend of those healthier money multiples and hopefully expanding from there. Finally, I think in terms of bonds, yes, I think Eric mentioned as well, we don't have any, we have a 2024 bond maturity. We've already mentioned the RCF discussions have already begun in terms of extending ahead of the bond maturity, but certainly that gives us some time, well within the framework of where we believe deleveraging is possible, and clearly where we are currently from a leverage standpoint, we don't think it would be the right time, nor do we have the funding requirement or refinancing requirement to go to the market today. So I would have thought addressing the bond is probably something that would be no earlier in our view currently to next year. I think it's something that realistically, if we could achieve the numbers we set out to achieve this year, we see further deleveraging in 2022. I think next year is the time we would begin to discuss that in earnest.
Thank you very much.
We'll go next to Peter Stalins with CVC Credit Partners.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for the call. I was just wondering if you could expand a little bit more on the direct real estate investments you're doing, which is, a slight change in strategy for you. Like, when you buy these real estate assets, how much equity do you invest in these projects, and how much debt do you typically raise against these?
Yes, it's quite a mix, actually, given the individual situation and particularly the status of a particular asset. So by way of example, the portfolio we reflected, the blended portfolio that we showed in the presentation, and that's an actual recent deployment, including some deals that are scheduled to complete in 2021. It included everything from a portfolio of smaller properties located and actually cherry-picked from a borrower in distress. In many ways, it was an NPL, much like NPLs we would have looked at from the secured NPL standpoint previously. However, in this specific situation, rather than go into bankruptcy and rather than the bank having to mark it down as a non-performing loan, we worked with both the borrower and the bank to complete an acquisition of the properties, effectively a debt restructuring by way of us acquiring the properties and the condition the borrower used the proceeds to pay down debt with the bank, where we were in direct dialogue as well. These are properties that, therefore, very much in the NPL continuum, although we didn't buy all of the properties the borrower held in their in this real estate company, only the ones that we felt had optimal liquidity. And it's a very straightforward process from here of disposing them one by one. Very limited work needs to be done. I think the benefit for us is we're able to offer one solution to the borrower at a time of need, and then we'll gradually, through a more orderly approach, sell the properties out. And the mix of property type as well is very consistent with what we would typically see in our NPL portfolios in Italy. However, because it was cherry-picked, it was more positively skewed, I would argue, toward residential assets, logistics assets, and some of the assets that we cut out, for example, were retail assets, where we knew liquidity in the current environment would be much worse. And that's one example. There's limited leverage at all on that. Across the entire portfolio, however, where we buy some more stable income generating assets included, we would expect, I think on that blended portfolio, the peak leverage on the portfolio would be about 60%. So that 60% asset level debt, which in a real estate context is quite prudent, and we believe quite low, against about 40% equity. It's also important to remember that this is a co-investment. So in order to diversify further, as we've done with NPLs, Anacat's private funds would be investing. And the typical mix, if we're targeting about $100 million of deployment in eighth this year, it costs probably at closer to $300 to $400 million. So the typical ratio of co-investment is about one-third in eighth and two-thirds in our private funds, obviously representing additional skin in the game from Anacap. And importantly, as I mentioned, the asset management, the responsibility of AIF across the entire investment, not just the co-invested portion, hence the opportunity for us to continue to grow our capital light income as part of that investment.
Yeah. Okay. So when I look at your ERC, then, like, what percentage of your assets within that ERC would have some form of debts against it, whether it's direct real estate or any other things where effectively the equity tranche right. In a larger investment?
Sure. I mean, right now it is fairly small. I don't think we've disclosed the exact percentage here, but that real estate portfolio, which we mentioned, I think is getting to around 6% of ERC currently. Currently, that only about half of that effectively has leverage on it altogether. And then in addition to that, we have effectively one other investment, which is a fairly small investment in Portugal with non-recourse leverage. And then finally, we have the sidecar facility, which is consolidated. You'll see the asset-backed facility that we do have on balance sheet as well. In aggregate, I think that totals, I believe it's somewhere around 15, maybe percent of the entire portfolio would have some form of asset-based financing against it. That's something we certainly can clarify further in the future, but it's still a relatively small portion. And it's also important to remember that other than where we consolidate the debt in the sidecar facility, the non-recourse debt, for example, on real estate, we are only taking the net collections through to our ERC after the repayment of debt. So that's reflected in our expected collections anywhere where there's that element of non-recourse debt at the asset level.
Okay, perfect. And that 15%, do you think that will go up more given that you're going to invest more in direct real estate? Do you have some cap on that you could maybe share?
Yeah, we don't have a formal cap. We do think it will go up, particularly where there's real estate opportunities. One of the things that we're aiming to do, certainly as we grow, is we expect a significant amount of deleveraging as a result, where we don't expect to have to increase debt on balance sheet, either in bond or RCF significantly, where we can use additional third-party funding, asset-backed funding, for example, in those real estate deals, to continue to grow and to delever the business overall more rapidly. So it does afford us the ability to access quite efficient, quite, we believe, prudent, but also low-cost debt at the asset level, which will increase, but it will also allow us to delever the overall balance sheet quite significantly.
Okay, thanks a lot.
We'll go next to Karen Miles with Credit Suisse.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. Just two for me, still staying on Peter's point on real estate. One, just a housekeeping. I think you said in the presentation you did 9 acquisitions in 2020, and then there was about $12 million out. I just wanted to ask, is there any how much is defers into 2021? Are those fully paid for? And then if they're not, as you pay more for them, will you consolidate more ERC, or is the ERC already fully accounted for today? That's just point one.
So as we mentioned in the presentation, we would expect in 2021 to deploy $15 million of further capital investment on the transaction that we've signed so far. Some of these projects are development projects, and therefore there's CapEx over several years. The way we account for it is that we only recognize the ERC when the investment is made, keeping the gross money multiple constant over time. So effectively, if a transaction requires, let's say, $20 million of future CapEx investment over a three-year period, we would only recognize on an annual basis, as the investment is made, the ERC that is linked to the specific investment for that specific year. So that's the way we account for it.
Okay.
So right now, when we say the $12 million was deployed in 2020, the ERC associated with these 9 properties is only the $12 million that was deployed in 2020.
Perfect. So it will grow. That's good. In the post balance sheet, how many additional properties have you acquired, and is there a cost line for that, or is that?
You mean the ones that we've signed that we mentioned for 2000 that we've signed but not completed? I think we're now at 3 additional properties that we've signed but not yet completed. That funding, like the others, will start in 2021. And then be deployed out over subsequent years as well. But again, following the same treatment where we expect to recognize ERC only as the capital is deployed.
Okay, great. And then just more broader question. Justin, I think you said you have more visibility on real estate now, and you know, it's easier to see that pipeline. I was just curious why that is. You know, what is it about this cycle or these opportunities that you know, I understand why banks aren't selling NPLs just yet, and you know, across the whole sector, where everybody's saying the same thing. But why do you think you're seeing more clarity and more supply on the real estate side that's getting you guys excited?
Well, I mean, I think banks are able to postpone and are only gradually recognizing provisions. I think there are a lot of sellers and borrowers who have been caught out more in the cycle, who don't have the luxury of waiting. And I think it's the distress that's being felt on them. Although obviously liquidity remains pretty strong, I'd say the one area of the market, we see good liquidity to small businesses, consumers, residential, individual homeowners borrowing money. But in the commercial real estate sector, I think where maybe leverage had already to some extent peaked, obviously, many asset types are falling out of favor. You have nervous investors, so we have sellers that include open-ended real estate funds that have redemption liquidity pressures of their own beyond even leverage. So I think it's a combination of all those factors. I mean, I would say we were in some ways as surprised versus, say, the last crisis, where credit spreads have been surprisingly, as we all know, resilient, and the funding market is generally healthy. And actually, you're seeing almost the inverse, where you're seeing asset prices fall in some cases before We're seeing credit spreads widen significantly. But indeed, I think it's really a combination of all those factors. And in some cases, as you'll see, these are directly a result of not only distress on the borrower, but an attempt and pressure from the bank to avoid recognizing another NPL. So across the investments we've made and signed, the majority of them are situations where either the borrower is selling proactively to avoid a default or bankruptcy, or the bank themselves are putting direct pressure on the borrower to do so. And in several cases, as we mentioned, we and ANICAP have been engaged with both parties. And I think that's where, for us, this is not new. This is a very natural extension of where we've already been operating. I mean, in many cases, it's literally the same banks that we've bought secured NPLs from before, who we believe we can bring an element of credibility when we see a relatively small mid-market sized property, not something that's necessarily getting attention from large global real estate funds, but could help a bank avoid recognizing an NPL and help a borrower potentially avoid bankruptcy. These are where we're seeing some of the most elasticity in pricing, I think it's fair to say, versus what we're seeing so far in the NPL market.
Great, very clear. Thank you for that. And just broadly, thank you. You know, you guys provide much better clarity on your path through 2021, you know, with respect to leverage and spending for all of us. We appreciate it, but not all your peers are as forthcoming. So that's it for me.
And once again, if you'd like to ask a question, that is star one at this time. And go next to Benjamin Beskir with TechU.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my question. Apologies, the line cut on my side when you were talking about RCF extension. Can you just go back on that and update on the ongoing discussion with banks and where these are going? Thanks.
So on the RCF, as I mentioned, we are starting discussions with the banks in the RCF syndicate at the moment. We will share financial projections today. We've already had conversation with the three banks in the syndicate in the last 3 days. So we're hoping that the banks will hold their current holding position, but we will explore as these banks go through their underwriting process. I think we would have visibility on each bank's appetite in the next 2 to 3 weeks. As I mentioned before, the expectation is that we would like to conclude the RCF extension by the probably the month of May. That would be the ideal from our side.
Which obviously gives us considerable headroom to ultimately. I think one thing I'd add is that, as we mentioned, we have quite strong liquidity already available. So when we talk about the RCF, we're always speaking to potential new lenders, but we don't have needs to expand the RCF. We're looking, to extend it, but we have strong liquidity and we're not necessarily looking to grow.
So we've not upsized, the size of the RCF will remain the same, and then we're just doing minor amendments and an extension to December 2023.
Okay, perfect. Thank you very much.
We'll go next to Christian Grani with Acunia.
Good afternoon. Just two quick ones. I think you mentioned on the 2021 collection forecast that we should expect that to be somewhat back-ended, and I think you mentioned a number for Q1 of, I think, 14 or 16 million, if I remember. Are you able to provide a quarterly breakdown of that 2021 collection forecast? And the second question is about the cost collection ratio. Is that elevated ratio something we should expect to persist in 2021, or when do you see that coming down?
I couldn't catch all of the question. In terms of the collection target, as I mentioned in the presentation, is very much weighted towards the back end of the year. Q1 target is 16 million. So I think we have a full-year collection target of 114 million. Think about it that it's probably a 40% in Q1 and 60% in H2. So that's kind of the breakdown. I don't know how much.
I think that's right. I think what you said in the second part of your question was around the cost to collect. I think it was elevated. That's, remember, that's a total all-in cost, including everything. So what we saw there was certainly an impact of the fall in gross collections last year and the fact that we pushed those out while obviously still incurring costs in the meantime. So we would expect that to reduce over time and return closer to the longer-term trajectory you've seen previously. So I think a significant amount of that was indeed due to the fairly sudden drop in collections in 2020.
Okay, and also not including the operation cost, the fixed cost, but just on the core collection cost.
Yes. Core collection costs, we do not see significant changes. I mean, the reality is, as our deployment shifts, as you know, from unsecured to secured, is a lower all-in cost to collect on a secured basis with higher balances, and indeed with real estate, those investments typically also will have a lower cost all-in to collect, including everything, costs involved in ultimately acquiring, managing, owning properties, and then disposing them, including any success-based commission similar to secured NPLs where we pay servicers on a success-based realization. Similarly, in real estate, we do the same. The all-in cost for real estate would be significantly lower, somewhere in the area of 12 to 15% versus maybe the 25 to 30% you would have seen historically on NPLs.
Great. Thanks.
And we'll go next to Niall Compton with GLG.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my question. Two, if I may. First of all, as you call out UK and France as potential markets to grow into, can you just expand on that a little bit? I mean, it seems to me you have, you know, clear core deep expertise in sort of, you know, Italy, Spain, Portugal. How, you know, easily do you think that expertise translates into these new markets that are sort of quite well covered by existing players? And do you have a sort of target geographical split, you know, 2-3 years out to give us a sense how big those newer geographies might get to? And then I guess the second question is just as you talk about courts being in Spain and Italy anyway, sort of below capacity still, you know, and understandably, as the capacity ramps back up to full, you know, as the pandemic sort of gets put into the rearview mirror, can you talk about sort of the prioritization of what the courts are going to focus on and how that plays your recovery curve? Is it more kind of prioritizing newer NPLs, and therefore, you know, some of your assets might still get, you know, back-ended in that ramp-up process? Some color around that would be helpful. Thank you.
Sure. I'll start with the questions on geography, and then maybe Ed can follow up on the third question. So I think UK,
sure.
France, I mean, it's important to remember, they're not new markets to us in terms of ANICAP. I mean, when we launched AIF in 2017, if you actually look at our historical track record investing in credit back to the beginning prior to the establishment of AIF, UK was a very significant component of that. A lot of it came down to where we felt best placed in terms of competitive advantages and returns. I mean, I think returns were a significant feature in that. Obviously, the UK market in more recent years, the volume of debt had dropped dramatically. The cost that you needed, a very large industrialized cost efficient model, certainly in the consumer space and real estate and secured debt was less of a feature of the market. So not new to us, but one we're returning to. I mean, obviously we have a significant team here on the ground. We're well known, I think, and well established. One of the investments in our pipeline, we are, again, as I mentioned with some of the others already signed, we have another investment where we're in significant negotiations with a leading UK bank to help complete another effectively restructuring where they're trying to avoid marking down a loan significantly and us acquiring the real estate directly. So we're really returning to our roots in many ways with the UK. France, although it's been a smaller market for us credit-wise historically, again, we have direct investment experience in our closed-end funds outside of AIF. Hasn't been a feature in more recent years, but certainly been one that's been growing. You have a combination of French banks, had been gradually increasing provisions in recent years, now would accelerate with COVID, And then also from a real estate perspective, similar dynamics where we're seeing in very top locations pressure on underlying borrowers. And that's where in the UK and France in particular, we're seeing some of these real estate opportunities emerge more rapidly, even more rapidly than credit opportunities. Obviously, markets like Italy, Spain, Portugal already have a significant volume of NPLs, so some of them are already coming to market. UK and France will be even slower to materialize. But the real estate dynamic I mentioned, we've seen consistently across all of those jurisdictions. I think where that leads us ultimately, I mean, clearly we've been focused on a geographic diversification. Obviously, we've been in an AIF context kind of 75-80% plus in Southern Europe. That's something that we do have a longer-term objective to rebalance. UK and France are obvious place to start for us. I would hope we bring that down over the course of the next 2 to 3 years to maybe more like 50 to 60% in Southern Europe. Not necessarily only UK and France. We certainly have pipeline in other jurisdictions in Northern Europe as well. But I think that's certainly the long-term balance. We would like to rebalance more to what would be reflective of our business historically would be more like 50% Southern Europe rather than, you know, 80% plus in Southern Europe.
On the question
of the NPL,
question of the courts, across our asset management platform, we have in-depth legal expertise. So in each jurisdiction, legal experts. So as we've done reforecasts, we've looked at a granular level at different types of procedures and different types of underlying customers. So for example, in Spain, commercial courts will going forward prioritize hearing new bankruptcy cases ahead of processing the proceeds and the release of cash from old bankruptcies. So in our projections, as one example, we assume a more protracted delay for our back book of bankruptcy cases in our Spanish portfolio. So everything's been built up kind of from on the ground insight in terms of our best guess of how different courts will operate, with specific adjustments and extensions for known areas where we believe courts will put things towards the back of the queue, whether it's longer dated bankruptcies or particular types of consumers in Catalonia and Spain as one example.
Okay, thank you. And so just to clarify on that last point, so is it fair to sort of categorize that then as sort of Spain is both furthest away from 100% capacity and more likely to prioritize newer cases, so you've got a little bit more of a lag. Portugal is probably close to the full capacity and therefore sort of processing old and new, comparably, and Italy's a little bit between the two. Is that sort of roughly the right way to think about it?
I think that's a reasonable assessment. Portugal's courts have been closed for the majority of this year, so the courts have been locked down. Italy is the closest to normality, with courts probably operating currently about 85 to 90%. Spain at circa 70%, and Portugal now probably, as we emerge from lockdown, between the two. But Spain's definitely the jurisdiction where there's most kind of bespoke treatment in terms of different types of cases and different types of prioritization.
Understood. That's very helpful. Thank you.
And there are no further questions in the queue. All right, and that concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.